The thing about hip-hop today is it's smart, it's insightful. The way they can communicate a complex message in a very short space is remarkable. That's a comment by President Barack Obama about the controversial musical and cultural phenomena known as hip-hop. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Where did hip-hop originate? How does it relate to spirituals, blues, jazz, and other forms of African-American music? What influence did Jamaica have on American hip-hop? How did groups such as Public Enemy draw attention from politicians and the media? What is the state of hip-hop today? Joining us for these and other questions about hip-hop are two guests. Craig Werner is professor of African-American studies at the UW-Madison, a nominating member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and author of numerous books, including A Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America. Also with us while on a visit to Madison is Harry Allen. Harry Allen is a hip-hop activist, creator of the Media Assassin blog, photojournalist affiliated with the group Public Enemy, director of the Rhythm Cultural Institute, and host of Nonfiction, a weekly radio show on WBAI in New York.
Welcome to University of the Air. Welcome back, Craig, and welcome for the first time, Harry.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure to have you here. Some real unknown territory for many of us, I'm sure. Hip-hop, did it originate in this country? Is it even possible to say where it originated?
Well, the standard story of that is that hip-hop grew up in New York City, usually the South Bronx. I know Harry has some things to say about New York City geography on that. But it has a lot of roots, particularly Jamaica. A lot of the early hip-hop DJs came out of Jamaica. Kool Herc's family was from there. Grandmaster Flash, I believe, his family was from the islands
of Barbados.
Barbados, yeah. So is it a New York thing or part of the diaspora?
Well, I would say that the South Bronx is generally given as a location. It's the first place that people play hip-hop music in public and recognize it as a unique thing, a distinct thing, distinct from what had come before. But any music is built on music that came before it. No music hops fresh out of its creator's mind, unrelated to the things that were made before it. And so the fact of immigration, the fact of the Caribbean as a site of origin for a lot of people coming to the Bronx and to New York at the time, and also the Caribbean as a site for certain kinds of music play and the priority and status of the DJ as a person organizing musical performances. The idea of a DJ, of a person playing pre-recorded music and manipulating the play of pre-recorded music as opposed to a live band being the way that music is generated in a public setting, that idea is critical to the development of hip-hop, and it's a big part of certain cultures in the West Indies, and especially Jamaica.
I have this image of when you say the DJ manipulating, and this may be a little old-fashioned, or maybe for the origins we're talking about, maybe not. The whole thing with the two turntables and you've got your hand right on the disc on the turntable.
Absolutely.
And running it backward and forward.
Yes, absolutely. To create the rhythmic sounds, temporal effects, and rhythmic effects. To see the sound that the record generates in normal, unaffected play as a starting point of creation. The idea is if you take any recording and you put a needle on it and let it play, it'll make whatever sound was put there. But if you then manipulate those surfaces, the surface of the needle and the surface of the recording against each other, and if you do other kinds of things with the playback of that sound, you create sounds that don't exist. That don't exist on that record. You create new sounds out of that process.
And don't try that trick at home, because most home turntables won't play backward and forward like commercial or DJ turntables will.
Well, a lot of DJs found out that they had to get professional turntables because they did try doing this, you know, in the early days at home and found out that stuff wasn't designed to work that way, or you were messing with daddy's records and daddy didn't like you messing with his records that way. So, yeah, don't try it at home.
So what has to be there for it to be hip-hop? Let's say you're listening to music and you're trying to say, is that hip-hop? What elements must be there? How do you even know it is hip-hop?
That's a really good question, and it's a question of the answer to which changes as we go on in time, because hip-hop takes on new sounds, patterns, experiences. But When we speak of hip-hop, for the most part, we're talking about, as I said, a form of musical and cultural practice with origins in the 1970s, early 1970s in the South Bronx. So there aren't a lot of musical practices that started in the South Bronx in 1970. So that kind of fixes it in one way. And then we talk about certain kinds of patterns of cultural use. We're talking about aerosol art, what's commonly called graffiti. We're talking about b-boying, which is also called breakdancing. We're talking about DJing. We're talking about emceeing or rapping. So we're talking about another a form that has these expressions as part of its whole. So people who do these things are part of hip-hop. But we're also talking about the awareness of this history. We're talking about everything that comes out of that history to the present. So I'm kind of giving a definition that's kind of organized by time and space. I haven't really yet told you what it sounds like yet or what that means. I'm just kind of giving you kind of like a shape or envelope definition of it. But because we're talking about graphic, melodic, vocal, and dance expressions, they all have different forms. But they're all based around syncopation. They're all based around the voice as a tonal ideal. They're all based around, especially originally, free public performances. They're all highly rhythmic, as I said, because they're syncopated. And we're talking about something which is rooted in a kind of play that is centered around, again, the manipulation of pre-existing forms, twisting them and bending them. You see that constantly. You see that in the vocal expressions of hip-hop. You see that in the dance expressions of hip-hop, in the graphic expressions of hip-hop, in the melodic expressions of hip-hop. This idea of folding, bending, twisting is a big part of all four forms.
I'm thinking about Curtis Blow's early hip-hop record, The Breaks, one of the first hip-hop attempts to put hip-hop on record, and thinking about the way in which The Breaks is, you know, that's The Breaks, kind of a bluesy attitude towards life, but also that break with the cultural continuity, that break with the mainstream, that break dancing, and that sense from the beginning that hip-hop kind of swerves you at times, then breaks you at times, and that seems to me to be a piece of the aesthetic.
I think it's an excellent point, and one that I think I overlooked. This idea of the focus on the break. And people often talk about the relationship of hip-hop to other forms or earlier forms of vocal performance, the Last Poets, for example, or other kinds of black orality. But what separates hip-hop vocal performance from others is the emphasis on the break, on complicated instrumental musical passages, funky instrumental musical passages manipulated with the use of turntables. And that's really what marks the beginning of hip-hop compared to other things, the start of it, this idea of using these pieces of music, short, syncopated, funky pieces of music, looped in effect by taking turntables and repeating those pieces of music while an MC raps over it or says rhyme poetry over that or encourages the DJ or challenges him or challenges the crowd. This is really what we're talking about when we say hip-hop music, what we commonly call rap music today. But hip-hop is the conglomeration of these forms, while rap is really the vocal instrumental expression of hip-hop.
Where does it work once you get into CDs? How do you make that whole system work with a new technology?
It's a great question. I think the first thing is that the development of CDs and the movement away from the production of music commercially on vinyl records created a real sort of musical arms race by DJs, or I should say accelerated one, because DJs had always been very protective of records. That is to say, it was very common in the early days of hip-hop when you're playing in public places for a DJ to say, "This week at the Park Jam, I'm going to break this record with this super beat on it that nobody knows about and the crowd's going to go wild."
Sure, the scoop.
Right. It's such a scoop. But I'm going to soak the label off this record first so that when people come up to my turntables and look and see, so they can copy it, all they're going to just see is black plastic or maybe just an old piece of white paper from what's left behind the label. So this idea of being very secretive and, you know, researching what you're going to play.
Proprietary. Yeah.
Yeah, proprietary, exactly, is a big part of it. But as recordings started going onto CDs and people started making fewer and fewer wax records, the ones that were out there became very highly valued. And so the first thing that happened is that you found people raiding record collections, garage sales, estate sales, just to find records, and they became very highly prized. Now, as that marketplace actually is coming back to some degree, the vinyl marketplace. But what then happened, because of the success of hip-hop, is CD turntable manufacturers actually started to make CD turntables which could digitally replicate the sounds and effects of scratching. So that's what you have actually now.
Talk about retro.
Yeah, exactly. You actually neo-retro. So it's a very interesting question, and it's a kind of interesting side development. And, of course, what you also have are those DJs who say, that's not hip-hop if you've got something that's artificially making the sound of a scratch when you manipulate it. So very interesting tangents all coming out of this question of, as you say, proprietary knowledge.
Can I ask you, Craig, because I know you have a chapter in your Change is Going to Come book about South Bronx and the hip-hop origins. Why there at that time? In other words, what was happening in South Bronx in the 1970s that led to this form?
Well, it was more or less ground zero for the collapse of America's industrial economy. The building of highways through the Bronx really undercut the community there in the way it did in Milwaukee and many other places. But one of the pieces that I think is most striking about the South Bronx is that it was a scene where the biggest black music stars who used to spend a lot of time, somebody like James Brown would play ghetto clubs all the time. He would be there. And during the late 70s, with the rise particularly of disco as an art form, there was a class dynamic in the consumption of black music that entered in, I think, that was different from what had happened before. So that the big disco artists and a lot of relatively affluent black folks could go see them at venues where they wouldn't have gone before. And one of the things that happened is the South Bronx wound up without a entertainment industry that was focused on it. And if you listen to a lot of the early hip-hop records, tapes that document that form, you hear a lot of overlap with disco, that a lot of the beats are disco or funk beats. They're the same beats that are being played in more upscale clubs. But there's a new economic niche in the South Bronx, which has just been abandoned by America. And there was a creative ferment. I mean, the kids there, both Latin and African-American, made it themselves. They had to, they filled a niche that was open. And so I think that there's a real connection between the increasing social isolation of poor communities in the United States, particularly poor black communities in the United States in the late 70s, and the rise of hip-hop.
That term hip-hop implies up-tempo. Is that always the case?
Great question. I wouldn't say it's always the case. I would say that music that is meant for dancing or oriented around dancing or social dancing often is up-tempo. If it gets too slow, you're now talking about love songs.
Right.
But for the most part, I think there is an implication from that word hip-hop. I think there's an implication of something that's up-tempo and something that's moving and something that's, if not fast-paced, at least upbeat, so to speak.
Isn't it almost always subversive, angry, politically charged?
Not early in the day, really. A lot of it was pretty good-feeling party music, actually. I think when hip-hop addresses politics, it's almost always angry. But early on, I mean, I'm thinking about the first hip-hop parties I ever went to, which for me would have been later than you, would have been early 80s, and they weren't particularly political in the open vibe.
I think that, as Craig said, the kind of political statements that encourage you to make a political reading, the ones that where it's fairly obvious that this person is talking politically, I think records like that come later. I think that for the most part, earlier records, when they deal with political issues, do so fleetingly. Someone might make a statement, a little couplet or something like that in a record, and then move on to something else. To a great extent, I think early records and early performances were, again, early vocalists are called MCs. And that idea is that we entertain, we keep the event moving, we keep it flowing, we keep people happy. And I think to a great extent, if you're doing records, about the despair of people's lives when they are coming from despair into environments where they are they're just really trying to alleviate some of the despair of their lives. The idea of talking about how bad their lives are doesn't really make any sense. It doesn't serve the function of the community. I think it's really after time, after some time, when people begin to conceive of new uses and possibilities for the culture, when there's a lot more discussion around it and a lot more thinking about it as a thing. You know, one of the questions I'm still trying to get an answer to and working on is the idea of when do hip-hop artists realize that there is a thing called hip-hop? Like when do they name it? When do they realize that this is something different? When does it start to be a psychology around it? And so I think it's only after you have some time with a culture can you start to actually, you know,
get it into perspective.
Get it into a perspective where you can start to do different things with it. The love song of J.R. Prufrock doesn't make sense until a certain point in time. And as I've said, the idea of playing with turntables doesn't make sense until turntables are very common and easy to, until you have an easy access to technology and until technology worked a certain way. It wouldn't have made sense when technology was really hard to come by and really expensive and not in everybody's homes. There has to be some facility with the technology, some ease of access for you to start playing with it.
So how does a hip-hop artist feel about having his or her work, let's say they put it down on vinyl, and they're just making the assumption that, okay, this is my version of it, but it's fair game for any DJ out there to recreate it. In other words, they don't worry too much about their original, the artistic integrity of their original product because they know it's going to be manipulated anyway.
Are you talking about sampling?
DJs start with a couple of LPs that they're manipulating them
yes.
to create a new product. And that's just an assumption made by the original artist who creates the LP?
Certainly initially, once non-hip-hop artists like James Brown or Brass Construction or, you know, anybody, once they started understanding that artists were rapping over their records or recombining them, I think a lot of people, first of all, a lot of the people whose music that they were using were not in hip-hop, not involved in hip-hop, and a lot of them were coming from the framework of, well, if you are going to use my music, I should get paid for you to use my music.
Sure.
So that was one issue. And then also, there are many who said, I don't like this music or I don't think this is music, so I don't really appreciate you using my music this way. So there was, I think, a lot of that.
That's what I'm getting at. Initially, you would have more of that attitude of the artist, but as hip-hop became more recognized form, people would actually start creating music expressly for this kind of recombination?
I don't know if I would say that. I don't know if I would say that for the most part, artists making albums or music were making them with the hope that they would get sampled or picked up. I wouldn't say that as much. That's not something that I've heard or of which I have knowledge. I think, though, that over time, this issue of using pre-existing recordings became much, much more complicated because it became a commercial issue, not only an aesthetic one. It became a question of copyright, publishing, and licensing. And then also because the way artists were using it, using these elements for pre-recorded records, there became a question of what is an appropriate commercial response to the use of something that's 2.5 seconds long from a record, a pre-existing record, you know. And that's the way a lot of artists were using records, especially at certain times in the history of the culture.
More on the history of hip-hop when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Learn the words. You might sing this, just a little bit of the taste of the bass for you. As you get up and dance at the LQ, with some denied defiant, I swing bolos. And then it clear the lane, I go solo. The meaning of all of that, the media is the wax. As you believe it's true, it blows me through the roof. Suckers, liars, give me a shovel. Some writers I know are damn devils. From them I say, don't believe the hype.
Yo, Chuck, they must be on a pipe, right?
Their pens and pads I snatch, cause I've had it. I'm not an addict, fiend, it for static. I see their tape recorder and I grab it.
No, you can't have it back, silly rabbit.
I'm going to my media assassin, Harry Allen. I gotta ask him.
Yo, Harry, you're a writer, are we that tight?
Don't believe the hype.
The last voice you heard was Harry Allen, media assassin for Public Enemy, from their 1988 album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, back with our two guests, Craig Werner and Harry Allen, as we talk about the history of hip-hop. Now, Harry, tell us about Public Enemy and your involvement with them.
Well, my involvement with P.E. begins before the crew exists. I met Chuck D., the founder, lead vocalist of the band. I met him in college. We were taking a class together. We took an animation class in our communications department. I was a communications major at Adelphi University, and we met there. And both found that we shared a love for hip-hop culture. And Chuck invited me to WBAU, which was the school radio station, to come up there on Monday nights. Monday nights, there was a radio show that they contributed to. They did an hour of audio production, of music production for this show. I was going up to the radio station as it was during the day, but by night I was long gone home. And so going up there at night, what I found was a scene of young local musicians, DJs, MCs, and other fans of this culture assembling and just really enjoying the culture I love so much at a very early time in its history. At this point, Rapper's Delight, which is the record that starts hip-hop as a commercial form, really, was only three or so years old. So this is still in the period where people were all saying that rap music was a fad and was going to go away. But I was surrounded with a bunch of people who took it extremely seriously and were good at it. And so I found myself hanging out a lot with them. And I found out that Chuck had a crew called Spectrum City Mobile DJs. Hank Shockley was kind of like the business manager, Svengali, and Chuck's good friend. Hank's brother, Keith, was the DJ. And they started inviting me around. They would be doing gigs on Long Island where we live, and we'd go out and to park jams here, or they'd be doing frat parties over there, and I'd be around them all the time. And we just became friends and very close allies around a form of culture that we loved. But it was years later, after certain tries and some failures, that ultimately they put together the band Public Enemy based on concepts that Chuck really wanted to apply and wanted to make current and make visible. He wanted to do a very particular kind of thing in music, and it was really with that goal and with that desire that Public Enemy was put on the map. But my experience with them goes back to the earlier days when we were all really just big fans of this culture and thinking very seriously about it.
How did you get the name Media Assassin?
I gave that name to myself.
And why? Explain it.
Because as a writer, I became very aware that much of media, or much of the discussion of black life in media, is hostile to black people, often relatively uninformed, judgmental. And I'm trying to think of a way of saying that it's unnuanced, that it comes from a perspective that to many black people is unfamiliar. It seems to assume things or not take into account things.
Just oversimplified.
Yes, oversimplified would be a really good way of putting it. And I decided that as a writer, what I wanted to do was write things that would X out things that were opposed to me or to the people I cared about or to the black existence. And so I used the word media assassin as a way of describing a way of being in the world, a way of being a writer. That the idea of my writing being hard, precise, accurate, not personal, business, just business, defensive and offensive. And certainly also in hip hop, it doesn't hurt to have a cool name. most artists, and I didn't consider myself an artist, but most musical artists certainly don't go by the names that their parents gave them. They make up a name that embodies some aspect of them and use that name to be known by. And so it fit in that way as well.
Some iconoclasm doesn't hurt, I guess, this sense of being, bucking authority or the preconceived notions.
Well, Bill's first name was probably not Buffalo.
Yeah.
But calling himself that, made an indelible word picture.
It's great marketing.
One of the things that struck me most about Public Enemy was that from the outside, it was a little bit hard to tell where the group started and stopped. That it felt like a collective. It felt like there was a communal vibe going on at Chuck D and Flavor Flavor, obviously, the front men. But as the story unwound, there were times when Professor Griff was at the center of it on stage. The S1Ws were very much a part of the show. And I was wondering, from your perspective, what was it like to be a part of that, what felt like a really experimental communal group?
Well, I think you described it accurately, Craig. I think that, one, Chuck was and is a big on applying people's skills in some way where he can use them, like being an identifier of talent, so to speak, and saying, hey, I could use that guy's ability here, you know, or I could make this happen with what that person is doing this way. So I think there were reasons, and there was Public Enemy clearly had a root group of people, but there was definitely a wide extended family of affiliates, if you will, affiliated individuals and people who supported the mission of Public Enemy aesthetically or intellectually or some other way, politically. And that may have been part of what gave you the perception that you had. I certainly know that I couldn't think of any hip-hop group then or since who had a journalist like associated with them, like who's like rapper, DJ in S1Ws, writer. I only realized how strange it was much later when I realized that we were the only ones who decided, like, if journalists want to write stuff about us that's wrong, we're going to write stuff about them.
What about the sort of in-your-face names like Bomb Squad or even Public Enemy, its name, or, again, Media Assassin.
Eric Vietnam,
yeah.
Sandler.
Right. I mean, and can you talk a little bit about the assumption, stereotyped or not, that a lot of the lyrics are very hostile, misogynistic, antagonistic, whatever. Can you talk about the, I guess, reaction against hip-hop and, for right or wrong, some of the negative connotations?
Well, I think pop culture has big problems talking about women in a way that women recognize as real, that women recognize as authentic to their experience. I think there's an ongoing schism between males and females about, like, what we should consider normal female behavior as such. And I think that you see this reflected in the way that men talk about females all the time. And I think it's very easy to slip into misogynistic thinking and statements, certainly as males. I think there are big rewards for doing so in our culture. And so to the degree that PE embody this with statements or attitudes, whatever, I'm almost in a way the last person who can really talk about it because, you know, I'm swimming in it. I'm soaking in it, as Madge said of the Palm Olive, you know. and I'm not saying this in other words, like, it's like when white people talk to me about racism. It's like, you're not credible. So in a way, like, anything I say is like, what can I say? We've been charged of it in certain instances. It's not really the charge people make most about PE. They make that charge of misogyny really in certain instances and more of other acts, more of other hip-hop acts that more talk about women or talk about women sexually or sexual availability of women. Certainly in terms of what you're saying about, you know, the words like Bomb Squad and Eric Vietnam Sadler, Media Assassin, I mean, all I'd have to say is, have you ever listened to the music of PE? Like, if you listen to it, like, it makes sense. It's the names are continuous with the landscape, with the audio landscape of Public Enemy. But I think that that just has to do with how music works and how we wanted it to sound. Like, we loved and love Jimi Hendrix and Prince and Sly and the Family Stone and James Brown. And we basically wanted to ask, what would it sound like if you played them all at once and then rapped over it? Like, what would that sound like? And so those were the kinds of records we made. You know, it was really to create something that had not yet existed and to just widen, like, the way people heard sound. Like, even that idea of hearing sounds together is something that sampling innovates. Like, the idea that you can have James Brown say, ha, and Aretha Franklin go, ah, and that's one sound now. But that wasn't one sound before. That was two sounds, mm-hmm. or that was two bits from a bigger sound. But now we have them as one sound. This is a sound that didn't exist in the universe before. And then when you put them with other sounds and then multi-track them, it's really like it's a fantasy. It's a dream or a nightmare that came out of living in the world of records and of recording, and it wasn't possible. Music always reflects the times and the technology and the causes and the issues of the day. Debussy represents a break with a certain kind of past. So does John Cage, and so does John Coltrane, so do the Rolling Stones. And Public Enemy represents a praxis. It's a moment and a series of moments and a series of possibilities that are real to us, or were real to us, because of how we saw everything that came before us. So if you hear the records, if you hear Brothers Gonna Work It Out, you wouldn't question why they call themselves a bomb squad. You wouldn't question it at all, because especially if you've never heard a record like that, it sounds detonative.
When I heard P, I always thought of them as the sound of the city at that moment in time, too, that it felt like New York to me at a tough moment, in the same way that Louis Armstrong felt like New Orleans or Duke Ellington felt like Harlem earlier. Mm-hmm. And I always thought about, particularly on Fear of a Black Planet, which starts with this amazing sound collage piece.
Contract on the World Love Jam.
Contract on the World Love Jam. And it reminds me as much of Stockhausen as anything that I heard in popular music at the time. And just that kind of incredible experimental energy was probably very much of that moment. And you probably couldn't do that again right now. Could you talk about that?
Well, I agree. I certainly agree in the sense that the compression, the dynamism of those records, the use of sound that way, it's a psychoscape that's being formed, and it's a feeling that's attempting to be drawn. I think it's less New York that I'm thinking of. Brothers Gonna Work It Out. It's less New York than it is urgency, paranoia, and
New York.
But
does that sound like New York to you, Craig?
But it also sounds like Lagos.
Yeah,
it also sounds
absolutely
like Lagos. It also sounds like when we went to Sydney, and we were in the Redfern section of Sydney, and I was walking there with original people who have been mistreated for decades, centuries, by the descendants, the convict descendants in Australia. And I looked at them, and I looked at their neighborhood, and I thought, this looks just like the South Bronx to me. I'm here on the other side of the planet, and it looks just like the South Bronx. Or when I'm in Brussels, and I'm watching non-white baggage guys carry the white businessman's bags around, I said, this looks just like home to me. I'm like, this is a global system. So that's the worldview, the platform that those records are attempting to describe. It's almost like asking the question, like, if you could make records that sound like what your emotions feel like, what would they sound like? And they would be strident, strong, hopeful. They'd be scared a little bit. They'd be tentative, but they'd also be dynamic and aggressive. But there were no records. There was very little music before that time that described the way we felt or wanted to be in the world. The records of Hendrix did not do it. The records of Prince did not do it. Babyface did not do it. Nothing else was doing it. So we had to forge something new that kind of represents how we wanted to feel. The music that, if it were a movie and we wanted to, the curtain to go up while we stood, that we'd want to hear. Like, what did he say in I'm going to get you, sucker, that every superhero needs theme music? That was our theme music. Public Enemy made the theme music for us and our collective. And then other people said, hey, this stuff sounds great. This is exactly how I feel as well.
So can you recreate it in a concert format, or is it a purely a one-shot thing?
Yeah, for the most part, when you're in concert, what you're doing is you're playing tracks back. You're not reproducing the production process. The
because you can't recreate the...
It's pointillist and it's fragmentary.
Two voices coming together.
Or even more, samples of dozens of tracks from all over the world of music compressed into a recording space. You're playing that music back for the audience there. It's kind of like if you were trying to do that in a concert, it'd be kind of like trying to do a sculpture of an egg as it's breaking when it hits the floor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like,
too many parts, too many times.
Too many places.
Yeah.
So P's concerts wound up being more like performance pieces in some ways than like traditional concerts. The sound, the appearance, and the immediacy of being there was a big part of it, particularly back at height of the popularity.
Well, I'll say that Chuck would always talk about performing records in a way where he knew he'd be able to perform them in concert. It's no, I don't know if it's a secret or not. He's talked to me. I don't think he's hiding anything. Where he said, like, one of the issues he had with Eric B. and Rakim, he loves Rakim, but he always talked about the difficulty of performing a record when on record you're going planet Earth. When you do that in concert, you've got to go planet Earth. But it's different than what you've done on the record.
Yes,
so you're a record that you've pretty much kind of performed on wax is like a whisper or softly stated. You don't have to recreate in the environment of the concert. So Chuck always did his records in a way where when he did them live, they would still have the same sound and power that he put them on wax. He particularly thought about that. Like he particularly thought about making records that he'd want to perform and that people would want to hear performed live.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like when Public Enemy began to draw attention from politicians and the media?
It was great. I mean, in other words...
And give us some examples of what was said and done.
What I would say is that there certainly became a point where people were really starting to make references to us. People were starting to see what P was doing as not just music, but as a form of political speech. And you would hear people either refer to us in statements, you know, or I can't think of how many times the term fear of a something got turned into something else. That idea of fear of a black planet becoming fear of a green planet or fear of a hemp planet or fear of a whatever. I mean, I think there was just a place where people more saw what Public Enemy was doing as a kind of political leadership. In the video for Fight the Power, Spike Lee's concept was to have P.E., which we actually did, leading a march through Brooklyn. Like, that's the video. The video is Public Enemy leading like a political march/rally through the streets of Brooklyn.
Performing as they do this?
As they do this. They're performing the record as they go through the streets of Brooklyn. It's like, and that's the concept, you know. And so I think that only makes sense if the crew has an image that supports that. If the way people see them correlates and makes that plausible and makes that credible.
We're going to look at the further implications of hip-hop when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Have you ever worn a mask? Yeah. 1 2 1 2. M to the A to the S to the K. Put the mask on the face just to make it next day. Threats be hawking me, jokers be stalking me. I walk the street and camouflage my identity. My posse in the Brooklyn wear the mask. My crew in the Jersey wear the mask. Stick up kids doing boogie woogie wear the mask.
The sound of Lauryn Hill and the Fugees, hip-hop. The name of the piece, The Mask. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our two guests for this hour, Craig Werner and Harry Allen. Has hip-hop then sort of created this whole culture of spin-offs? Put all this in perspective for us in the last, what would it be, 25 or 30 years?
Well, I think what's very remarkable to me as a person who remembers the culture at a time of relative infancy is how widely spread it has become, that hip-hop has crossed borders, that the English language has not really, that you can find people performing hip-hop or variations on it adapted to their own particular cultural needs in pretty much every country in the world, and that in many of them, for some reason, it serves as a way of voicing dissent, making a critique of local politics, or speaking of the ambitions that the young people of those nations have for their cultures. That hip-hop has taken root in places around the globe where it's seen as kind of like the phone booth that you go into and you change into the person, not Superman, but the person who's going to stand up for right. That's the thing you go to. You go to hip-hop. You don't go to to other things, or you don't go to country and western. You don't go to European classical. You go to hip-hop for this. That's something that's really profound to me. And I started to become aware of this worldwide impact when Public Enemy started to tour back in the late 80s. And I remember them getting mail that they'd have up at the studio, their studio, which we'd go over there, and they'd have boxes of this mail from seemingly every country in the world. And that was a trip to me, that the guys that I had known and, you know, gone to White Castles with at Hempstead were now getting mail from South Korea or from London or from Greece or whatever. So I began to see it then, but that certainly was only the beginning of what we now see, like countries with a hip-hop tradition. Like when they tell the story of how hip-hop got to Greece, it's a different story than the story of Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash and Kool Herc. They have other names and other narratives and other histories, and they are all reaching to this form that came from near where I live to explain what's going on where they live.
Any place where it's banned?
I think, you know, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. I know that I just did an article about about a year and a half ago, about a hip-hop band in Palestine called Dam, D-A-M. And they are doing amazing things using the culture as a form of political protest. And I certainly know that, in fact, there was a documentary made about them recently called Slingshot Hip-Hop. And I don't know if you'd say it's banned, but part of the narrative of this film is these guys who are Arabs living in Israel trying to meet up with other rappers from Gaza. And just the whole film is about them trying to meet these guys, like several dozen miles away or whatever it is. But because of the whole way that the nation of Israel is organized, in a way it dominates the West Bank and Gaza, the difficulty they have meeting. So I think the political realities on the ground, wherever people live, and speaking out against the government is not received well here in the United States, but it's received less well in many, many other places, and oppressively in many places. In many places, you just cannot do it. And hip-hop encourages that kind of bravery and that kind of audacity.
And what directions do you see hip-hop going in now? In other words, is hip-hop alive and well? Is it evolving into something else that will have a different name and we just don't know it yet?
Well, I think one of the answers builds on what Harry just said, that it's creating hybrid forms with almost every form of global music. One of my favorite hip-hop cuts the last few years is Punjabi MC with Jay-Z working with South Asian Bhangra music and hip-hop, a group called Ozamatli out of Southern California, El Gran Silencio out of North Mexico are merging hip-hop with various traditions. And just, it's like evolution exploding in some ways, which then circles back to that first question of, is it still hip-hop at that point?
I think the tendency is really for musics to disappear. Like and disappear into other musics in a way where you may not even, you know, recognize them anymore, where they become so subsumed in other things that you don't even see them anymore. And I think that's ultimately where it will tend to go, unless somebody like does something else. Somebody may then pull it back by doing something that's considered audacious or something that's considered, you know, maybe even probably bad form. You know, like they say, all new forms of art are ugly.
Because you're unused to them.
Yeah, because you are. Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's going in both directions, in many, many directions. I don't think there's any one direction. I think there are directions that it's going that to me are unpalatable. And I think there are directions that are going that are very exciting. And I think there are directions I just can't make any sense of. But, you know,
it's with so many art.
Yeah. It's on its own in a way. It's like, you know, it's left a nest. It's like, bye bye. You know, right home every now and then, you know, come by. Don't forget your old folks. But, you know, it's gone.
Now, who do you see as some of the heroes of the story of hip hop? In other words, if you sort of look at this history of the art form from when it began to now, who stands out as sort of making a crucial difference?
You mean besides P.E.? Yeah. Is that Public Enemy?
Spoken like a true assassin.
Well, without saying names of people, I would say this. I would say the heroes of hip-hop culture are all the people who made it and who did it under duress and against difficulty, and those who stuck to an ideal about it, even if it wasn't going to make them rich or famous. And I would say those who, especially the founders, especially the first performers of it, the people who shaped it when there really wasn't anything yet to shape, when there wasn't a tradition, when there really wasn't a history, but who believed in what they were doing and strove for a certain kind of purity. I think those are the true heroes. And I also think that moment, that should inflective moment when hip-hop starts to separate, it starts to become its own thing from the mass of culture that it pops off of, I think that is probably the least understood and most significant moment in the culture's history. And it's the one that draws me endlessly, those first 3 minutes, as they say, that time period in development. And I consider those people certainly my heroes.
Is there hip-hop without words? Instrumental hip-hop?
Well, certainly, absolutely. Absolutely. But it inevitably comes back to words. It comes back to language, I think. I mean, DJs can scratch and cut records, and certainly there are hip-hop production techniques. But inevitably, it comes back to language, because I think language is, language is the thing that drives us. Even if we're making instrumental music, often we're trying to evoke the plaintiveness of language. We're trying to evoke, the sensuality.
Sure.
And
the sound of that saxophone imitating the human voice.
Yeah, yeah. It's trying to evoke something about words and the tongue and vocals.
Lyrics written down for a performance or improvised or a combination?
All of the above. Some artists write down things and perform them. Some artists say things off the top of their head. Some artists work in a kind of combinative mode of free association. People do all kinds of things to get it out, to make it happen.
Craig, let me ask you, because you've written about blues, soul, jazz, different forms. Hip-hop, what does it add that no other form does for you?
Well, I think of Amiri Baraka's phrase, the changing same about black music, that from the day that West Africans were put on the ships, they were making sounds to articulate what life was to them, and those sounds reached out and touched other people in different ways. It goes back to gospel, blues, jazz. And hip-hop, for me, carries that story on. So at a given moment, the time that P came around, it was a statement that, to quote to Harry Allen, don't believe the hype. More than anything else, it says keep your distance from this mainstream glitz. Now, obviously, hip-hop has fallen victim to that in many forms, but in many forms it continues to resist. And for me, hip-hop has been a message of resistance that came out in my lifetime at a time when people really needed to hear it. And that's why Public Enemy, Grandmaster Flash were as important as they were.
And I just really briefly, I would just add and say that's, I think Greg is very correct. And I think when I first started to try and study the culture and think about it as more than just a listener, what was most compelling to me and what I most saw others not seeing was that it was part of a continuum of black cultural resistance and black cultural creation, and that it wasn't a freak occurrence. How much more plain could it be then to literally take the records that our parents and our aunts and uncles listened to and make new culture out of that? How much more direct could it be as to say, this is part of you? And so I think that Craig has hit it right on the head.
Harry Allen and Craig Werner, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. It was 40 years ago in April that Gaylord Nelson launched the first Earth Day with the participation of 22 million people. We'll find out what the status of Earth Day in 2010 is next Sunday afternoon at 4. Join us for University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.